Adam Johnson has said his latest novel, The Orphan Master's Son, in a North Korea where even the smallest details of everyday life are dictated by the dear leader, Kim Jong-il. The book's hero is Jun Do, who learned at an early age that his survival depended not only on being able to withstand terrible deprivation and torture, but also on being willing to inflict that deprivation and torture on others. Despite its harsh subject matter, the novel is often laugh-out-loud funny. In his January 15th review in the New York Times, Christopher Beha called it an ingeniously plotted adventure that feels much shorter than its roughly 450 pages and offers the reader a tremendous amount of fun. Random House is the publisher, and I'm very pleased that it brings Adam Johnson back to our show today. Hello.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks.
Although this book is really funny, it's not something you'd want to read while eating lunch, at least some of the chapters. Were you at all concerned that your graphic descriptions might put some readers off?
Well, I studied North Korea for many years while writing the book, and especially the testimonials of defectors who'd gotten out of the gulag system there, the Kwanliso system. There are not that many of them, and their stories can't be verified. But they tell tales that are so harrowing that honestly I couldn't put that material in the book. It was so dark that it outweighed the humanity of my characters, and that's what I was trying to do, humanize people that we can't really get a good look at.
Now, it's interesting that when you started writing this book, you looked for novels about North Korea written by North Koreans but couldn't find any, even by ones who escaped and moved to South Korea or Japan?
Well, probably the first answer is that there are books written by North Koreans, but not ones that don't go through the approval of the state censorship system. And probably the books that we do have been commissioned to glorify the regime. And I did read a couple books like that about...
No, but I mean, people have left, and none of them have written novels. I mean, some have written articles, as you point out, and memoirs. But
that's right. And to this issue of the defectors, there are more than 6,000 defectors last year alone. There are a couple poets who are working, trying to put their work into poetry. But I find that folks who've been traumatized so deeply, and especially folks who've been trained their whole lives to never reveal their secret selves, to never communicate anything personal lest it get them in trouble, have a really difficult time putting their experiences into narrative.
Many of the situations you've included in this novel could be called Kafkaesque, except that Kafka was inventing a world, and to some degree you're really describing a true situation.
The world is nonfiction that I'm setting my work in, but we truly don't know how people's lives work, how they retain their humanity, their identities in places where self-censorship and group censorship are really total. So I thought this is exactly what literary fiction could do, is to fill in that human void.
I imagine that it was completed long before Kim Jong-il died in December. Have you seen any signs that life will improve for the ordinary citizen under the leadership of his youngest son, Kim Jong-un?
In North Korea, really there's no alternative reality than the one that the Kim regime has been creating to sustain itself for about 60 years. There are no radio stations or TV broadcasts or magazines that have any other possible way of living. And so one thing I do know about the regime change is that they need Kim Jong-un. He is the person who continues that narrative, and without it, there's no way for them to control the people. So we don't know who's in power, whether it's a junta or Kim Jong-un or an uncle or an aunt, but he's the necessary figurehead.
And soon to be called dear leader as well, I assume.
Well, we had the great leader was his grandfather, and the dear leader was his father. They've been floating in the propaganda papers, the Rodong Sinmun, which I read every morning.
Do you read Korean?
I don't. The Japanese translate the news out of the KCNA, and the Rodong Sinmun is the Workers' Party paper from Pyongyang. So I read it translated every morning. And they've been trying on supreme leader, glorious leader. I think they're just floating things to see what sticks.
Your hero, Jun Do, has grown up as an orphan in the Long Tomorrow Orphanage in Chungjin, North Korea. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't believe that he's an orphan. Why does he think that the head of the orphanage is his father?
Well, I knew someone who worked with orphanages in Korea very closely. And, you know, the fates of orphans there are much different than here. They don't really expect to be adopted. They're more like child labor. And it's true in North Korea that orphans are sent into the military for the most difficult tasks at an early age. And so the fate is a fairly grim one.
They're also given names rather than they don't retain their own name, their birth name?
That's something I concocted.
Oh, that's
that element was fiction.
That way you could call your character Jun Do, kind of like John Doe.
That's right. Well, that's a name, you know, in Korea, a common name. And I also wanted to work in a central glorifying element of North Korean life, which is martyrdom in the Revolutionary Martyrs Cemetery, which came to play a critical role in the rest of the book.
So what leads him to think that the head of the orphanage is his father?
Which just seemed like, as I was trying to create the interior life of someone who's existing in circumstances which could not be set more against him, I thought that, like all people, we create scenarios and delusions that make life more livable, that he might have some authority given to him if his father was the orphan master, then maybe he wouldn't feel as responsible when he delegated dark duties to others.
Well, Jun Do's mother is not around. Does he have any idea of what happened to her?
Well, you know, when you go to the DPRK, you'll notice that everyone in the capital is beautiful. That struck me right away. Every hostess, every traffic officer, every museum docent, every person I came across, especially the women, were lovely.
How were you able to get in?
Well, if I can just finish that thought, that all the time they're bussing people in from the countryside, citizens, civilians, peasants often, and you can see that the people who are out away from the capital are living very difficult lives. They're sunbeaten, their dentistry, you can visibly tell that they're under much harsher conditions. And just my observation that the women in the capital were beautiful and that maybe this was a different fate for women outside the capital, you know, was borne out by my research that women are shuttled in to keep beauty around the dear leader.
So his mother may very well have just been brought into Pyongyang. The idea that, and I did ask you how you got in, because not everybody can get a visa to North Korea.
That's right. As an American, it used to be impossible to go, and then it was very difficult.
And weren't you not even allowed at some point by the American government?
No. The State Department never spoke to me about my trip in any way.
I thought it was Albania, Cuba, North Korea.
Right. No, they haven't shown any interest. You know, I had a friend who has an NGO there and who knew the North Koreans, and I kind of went in as his assistant.
The idea that the identity of each individual is fragile and that it can be irrevocably changed in an instant runs throughout your book. At one point, a coworker tells Jun Do that in North Korea, a person's story is more important than the person himself. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you set out to explore when you began this novel?
Well, the question of how you retain your humanity in a place where it's dangerous to do so. How do you identify yourself and individuate yourself in a place where you're given an identity was fascinating to me as a writer. And I wondered, you know, where do loved ones share their true thoughts about the regime? How do parents prepare their children to sequester their own desires to fulfill a role and therefore survive? And I really looked for these moments to kind of flesh out and try to bring a humanity where I couldn't find it.
Adam Johnson is my guest. His latest novel is The Orphan Master's Son. It's published by Random House. Jun Do changes jobs frequently. When he leaves the orphanage, he joins the military, receives some rather extreme pain training that comes in handy later, and then he organizes raids to kidnap Japanese citizens wanted by North Korean officials. He's sent to language school to learn English. He's stationed on a fishing vessel where he's charged with intercepting foreign radio transmissions while at sea. You've given him almost all the jobs possible.
Man, I want to read this book now. You know, I researched that society at all levels, and I wanted to, you know, maybe in a Dickensian way, show the reader what it was like in Pyongyang, on the coast, in the military, and to have all these portraits so they had as large a feel for that society as possible. And we move all the way up to the dear leader, Kim Jong-il.
In one of the funniest sections of the book, Jun Do accompanies a small group of North Korean officials on a trip to Texas to meet with a U.S. senator and his family. And while he's aboard the 47-year-old Russian airplane that's taking them to the United States, he and his companions are briefed on some of the cultural differences that they should expect to find when they arrive. Could you read that section of the book for us?
I'd be happy to. They're on a plane, they're headed to America, and they're getting a little lecture about how Americans behave from the oldest diplomat among them, Dr. Song. Then Dr. Song got practical. He said it was okay to wear shoes indoors in America. Women were also free to smoke in America and should not be confronted about this. He explained that disciplining other people's children in America was not okay. He drew for them on a piece of paper the shape of a football. With great discomfort, Dr. Song touched on the idea of American standards of personal hygiene, and then he delivered a mini lecture on the subject of smiling. He concluded with dogs, noting how Americans were very sentimental, with a particular softness toward canines. "You must never hurt a dog in America," he said. "They are considered part of the family and are given names, just like people. Dogs also have their own beds and toys and doctors and houses, which should never be referred to as warrens."
Adam Johnson reading from his novel, The Orphan Master's Son. Things don't go all that well during the trip to Texas, and it leads to real problems for Jun Do.
Mm-hmm. The North Koreans have a history of a lot of their escapades going wrong. Jun Do is a character who grows up in the worst possible circumstances, though real circumstances for many people in that nation right now. The stack is decked against him as much as it could, and in the beginning, the book is just about the struggle for survival against all these forces oppressing him. But as he moves forward and has different roles in the military, he comes up in a tunnel in South Korea and sees their life, as he kidnaps people in Japan. And this society was notorious for kidnapping Japanese citizens for 2 decades. He gets to see the lights, see the people moving on the streets, hear their language, see how they entertain themselves. And in his mind starts blossoming a different possibility of what his life might be like. And he begins to act on that and to write the script of his own story for once.
But then he winds up in prison. Is this a pretty accurate description of a prison in North Korea?
Well, a lot of people in North Korea go to prison, and a lot of them go to prison for no reason whatsoever, like the North Korean soccer team, famously. The gulag system there is really a pretty nightmarish system. There's the main prison that people maybe have heard of. It's called Yodok. It's prison 15. There's a prison inside a prison. You're redeemable or irredeemable. And when you get into a Kwanliso, an irredeemability prison, you never come out.
Kim Jong-il plays a big role in a part of this book. And he comes off as a buffoon who wears platform shoes and jumpsuits and watches Iron Chef. In his New York Times review, Christopher Beha, who really liked the book, still objected to your depiction of such a repugnant mm-hmm. dictator as a merry prankster.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand his concern?
Well, I'm not sure I know the concern that he has. Actually, I would take issue with the fact that this character was a buffoon. I thought he was quite sharp. He's quite an intelligent man. He survived many coups against him. He survived international powers from the largest forces for many years and retained an iron grip on a nation which no people have. And Madeleine Albright spoke of his brightness, of his humor, of his quickness to make jokes, and that he did like pranks.
You use several different narrators in the story. You've told parts of it in Jun Do's voice, in the voice of another character, Commander Ga, in the voice of a young government interrogator, and you've also written some of the novel in third person. Why did you choose to switch from one voice to the other?
Well, to begin with, I was writing about a culture that was not my own. And not only that, the Korean culture differences aside, I was writing about a section of that society that was completely inaccessible. And so I started by using research and fact, especially at the beginning of the book, and having an objective narrator. But after I studied the society for years and read many narratives and oral histories of defectors, I felt comfortable enough to try it the first person, which, you know, is actually inhabiting the voice of another person. You know, it would be easy to make a transgression, but also is a great act of empathy, I feel.
Did you also think about how the Korean language is different than the English language?
Well, if I'd have known I was going to spend 6 years writing a book in North Korea, the first thing I would have done was learn Korean. That was my major mistake.
You didn't know it was going to take you this long. This is your third book. You were here 10 years ago to talk about your story collection, Emporium. So This has taken up over half of the time since?
More than half of the time. I wrote my second novel pretty quickly. It came out in 2003. I did have three children in those years and, you know, worked my way into a job. But I did spend 6 years on this book researching. And maybe that first year I didn't know it was exactly a novel. I was just playing with voices and materials and sketching out. I was fascinated by propaganda, especially.
Well, you have to be very pleased by the reviews, especially the one from Michiko Kakutani, who is not always the kindest reviewer. She called this, said you've written a daring and remarkable novel here.
I don't really look too closely at reviews. I have been out giving readings, and the thing that means the most to me is when people who've read the book come up and really speak to the ways in which they connected to it. And when I meet people who haven't read the book and they hear me bring a piece of it to life and are really engaged.
Have you spoken to Koreans?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And do they feel that you've done this correctly?
You know, I showed it to two Korean-American friends, and that would be different than a Korean friend or a North Korean friend, of course. And they said, you know, you did a pretty good job. You didn't get everything perfect, but you wouldn't anyway. And I think that's probably true. There's some cultural nuance, some inflections that I think I could never get right.
Adam Johnson teaches creative writing at Stanford. His fiction has appeared in Esquire, The Paris Review, Harper's, Tin House, Granta, Playboy, as well as Best American Short Stories. And his third book is a novel called The Orphan Master's Son. It is published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us to talk about it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.